News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United Nations said Wednesday that the Libyan capital saw its most intense fighting overnight since the forces of General Khalifa Haftar began their battle to take Tripoli earlier this month. The UN's top diplomat in Libya condemned the shelling on Twitter, saying that it was a horrible night of random shelling of residential areas for the sake of 3 million civilians living in Greater Tripoli. These attacks should stop now. To that end, the UN Security Council has been considering a draft resolution this week calling for an immediate de-escalation and ceasefire. Diplomats said that Russia had objected to the naming of Haftar's Libyan National Army in the text as originating the new violence, but after a revised draft was circulated Wednesday afternoon, it did not appear to satisfy Moscow, which raised objections, as did other council members. North Korea claims to have test-fired a new tactical guided weapon. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
According to state media, North Korea has test-fired what's described as a new type tactical guided weapon. The state-run Korean Central News Agency says North Korean leader Kim Jong-un observed the firing of the unspecified weapon. North Korea's weapons testing had largely halted since a series of tests in 2017. But in late February, a nuclear disarmament summit in Hanoi between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump collapsed without a new agreement. The Associated Press could not immediately and independently verify North Korea's claim of the weapons test. I'm Mike Rossia.
The former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, has died after shooting himself in the head. This happened as police tried to arrest him on corruption allegations tied to Latin America's largest graft investigation. Garcia was 69 years old. This is VOA News. The United States announcing new sanctions on Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the administration's implementing a 1996 act giving Americans the right to sue mostly European companies operating out of property Cuba seized when Fidel Castro took power. Every president since Bill Clinton had suspended the right in part to avoid trade clashes with Europeans who were now vowing to protect their businesses. The U.S. says there will be no exceptions.
Any person or company doing business in Cuba should heed this announcement.
The move could affect dozens of Canadian and European companies to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. Sagar Magani at the White House.
In Venezuela, people are welcoming the arrival of humanitarian aid from the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society. The delivery of such aid has been a focal point in Venezuela's power struggle. Until Tuesday, embattled President Nicolas Maduro had refused to allow any flow of aid, even insisting his people did not need it. The United Nations says a quarter of Venezuela's 30 million people urgently need food and medical help. French President Emmanuel Macron met with his cabinet Wednesday to discuss the restoration of Notre Dame Cathedral. AP correspondent Zaria Shockley.
Macron said the renovations to restore iconic 19th century spire, vaulting, and two-thirds of the cathedral's roof would be completed in time for the Paris 2024 Olympics. However, experts say that the ambitious timeline appears insufficient for such a massive operation. The comments came as Notre Dame's rector said he would close the once-functioning cathedral for up to 5 to 6 years. He said that a segment of the near 900-year-old cathedral may be gravely weakened. I'm Zaria Shakli.
Reports citing relatives of former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir say that the ousted leader has been moved from house arrest to prison, but protesters who are demanding civilian leadership instead of the transitional military council say that they are skeptical. Get more from correspondent Saba Marine.
Reports on Wednesday said the ousted former president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, has been moved from house arrest to federal prison. Unnamed members of Bashir's family told Reuters news agency, the BBC, and others he was moved to Kabir prison in Khartoum late Tuesday, while prison guards told CNN they saw Bashir's arrival at the facility. Kabir prison is where Bashir locked up many of his opponents during his 3 decades in power.
Israel's president has formally nominated Benjamin Netanyahu for a fourth consecutive term as prime minister. In one of the president's few non-ceremonial roles, he said Netanyahu Wednesday was assembling a governing coalition. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe is celebrating 39 years of independence today amid serious economic and political problems.
Today we are discussing where the price of bread has risen to $3 to $4. There's no employment for young people. Politically, in terms of war, Zimbabwe is independent. But economically and other fears of the constitution, we are not.
Bishop Gondo is the director of the National Association of Youth Organizations, the first independence commemoration since the government agreed to compensate white commercial farmers for their land. Health officials in the DRC report 17 new Ebola cases. Rwanda's national airline Wednesday launched direct flight to Kinshasa, and Cameroon separatists say they are emboldened following their Berlin conference.
We are determined more than ever before to provide our boys in Ambazonia every piece of equipment they need to withstand the army of French Cameroon.
Chris Anu is the spokesman for Cameroon's Ambazonia separatist movement. And amid Trump administration cutting foreign aid, daughter Ivanka promises support for African women. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe is today, Thursday, celebrating 39 years of independence amid serious economic problems. Once Africa's breadbasket, the country today is experiencing an ailing economy characterized by cash shortages, high unemployment, high cost of living, and fuel shortages. Reporter Kuzai Zivinashe takes a look at Zimbabwe's journey since independence in 1980.
Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament business and politics in Zimbabwe. He explains why young blacks took part in the liberation war.
The promise of a new Zimbabwe, the prospect of an independent and free Zimbabwe, the idea that they could live freely in their own land, the idea of one man, one vote, the idea that they should not have to live under the oppression of another race. All these things contributed to them taking up arms.
Meshack Gondo is the national director of National Association of Youth Organizations. He says Zimbabwe today is far from the Zimbabwean dream that liberation war heroes fought for.
When the young people went for war, they were fighting for total liberation. But in practical, this is not what we are seeing. Today, we are discussing where the price of bread has risen to $3 to $4. There's no employment for young people. Politically, in terms of war, Zimbabwe is independent. But economically and other fears of the constitution, we are not independent.
Dodo says that promise of a new Zimbabwe hasn't been fully realized.
Things have fallen apart. Those dreams, those young people who went to war in the 70s have become the very thing that they were fighting against. They fought against the white man and now they're in a position of power. Now they've become the oppressors of their own people.
The picture of Zimbabwe today is gloomy. The older generations have seen Zimbabwe's past brighter days, and optimists are hopeful those days will come back to this southern African nation. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Zimbabwe's white farmers, whose land was taken by the government, are cautiously hopeful about a promise by President Emmerson Mnangagwa to give them at least partial repayment. As Koloma Mavunga reports from Harare, the promise comes as Zimbabwe celebrates 39 years of independence today, Thursday.
On Sunday, state media quoted President Emmerson Mnangagwa as promising partial compensation for white commercial farmers whose land was seized under former President Robert Mugabe and redistributed to blacks. He said the government would pay for improvements to the land, such as buildings or dams. Ex-farmers are now submitting requests for compensation at the offices of the Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union. One of them is Glenn Johnson, whose mother, Agnes, was displaced from her farm about 17 years ago. Since then, she has been living in Harare with her son. Johnson says he is taking the president's promise with caution.
It looks like we've been promised that steps have been taken. So now we are taking these steps. Will we get the money at the end of the day? Obviously, time will tell.
The land seizures began in 2000 with the backing of Mugabe, who said they would correct colonial imbalances. Farm production plunged, and critics blamed the seizures for the collapse of Zimbabwe's economy. Others blamed the collapse on targeted Western sanctions imposed in 2002 in response to alleged election rigging and human rights abuses. Douglas Mahia of the ruling ZANU-PF party does not think Zimbabwe should compensate white farmers who, in his view, took the country's land at the point of a gun.
But we are saying, at least it's important that we compensate for their sweat. But when that happens, then the international world must accept Zimbabwe in the global family again, economically and politically.
The Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union says it has received nearly 1,000 applications for compensation, which it will submit to the government. Ben Gilpin, the director of the union, says the possibility for compensation gives his members some hope ahead of Zimbabwe's Independence Day this Thursday.
I think for many people, the last 20 independences have come and gone without such promises being even hinted at. And now the promises that this is being dealt with seriously. So we appreciate that.
Meanwhile, Mnangagwa's government says it hopes Zimbabwe's cold relations with the West will thaw and that the ailing economy will improve so that Zimbabweans can fully enjoy their political independence. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonia separatist movement says it is determined more than ever before to fight a war against President Paul Biya's military. Chris Anu, spokesman for the self-declared Republic of Ambazonia, says the movement got a boost from stakeholders during a four-day conference that concluded April 14 in Berlin, Germany. On Wednesday, the European Union Parliament called on the African Union to step up efforts in mediating the conflict. Otherwise, it says, the conflict should be put on the high agenda of the UN Security Council. Chris Anu says the Berlin conference brought together all stakeholders to strategize on how to wage the war in Ambazonia that he says is being waged by the Cameroon military.
This is what is going on as I speak. Paul Biya and French Cameroon have refused to come to any negotiating table or initiate any form of dialogue or initiation, despite all pressure upon them to do so by the international community. And so we figure out the only option that we have is to prosecute this war with all the military might and force that we can afford. And so coming out of Germany, we are determined more than ever before to provide our boys on ground zero in Ambazonia every piece of equipment they need to withstand the army of French Cameroon occupying our territory.
You said you were supplied all materials needed by your forces. Did you get pledges from people to give you money to support your war effort?
We did. That was one of the main reasons we put that conference together, to re-energize and reinvigorate our people towards supporting the war. And I think that we left there with everyone very, very revived and enthusiastic about raising support to support our boys who are defending the territory.
But Chris, you said that President Paul Biya has refused to negotiate. The president has said that any negotiation must start with you laying down your arms and returning to being part of the nation of Cameroon.
He is refusing to acknowledge the problem. We cannot lay down our arms because we did not declare war and we are occupying no other territory other than Ambazonia. He hasn't initiated any dialogue. And should he initiate one, we would be the ones asking him to withdraw his troops from our territory. Once his troops are withdrawn from our territory, we can then think of sitting down with him to discuss the terms of separation. Because what we are doing, we are only defending ourselves.
There was a story in the Cameroon Tribune about civilians being arrested as security forces raided Boya in search of your fighters. Do you know about that?
We are very much aware about that. Not only are civilians being arrested, civilians are being pursued and killed by French Cameroon forces, not just in Boya. In the northern zone in Bamenda and in the southern zone in Boya and other towns, people are being indiscriminately massacred by French Cameroon forces. If you are watching the social media, you will see horrible, gory images coming out of Cameroon. It will shock you that those atrocities are being committed by French Cameroon government forces. And unfortunately, the international community is paying a blind eye to these atrocities that are taking place in Cameroon and Ambazonia, perpetrated by French Cameroon on a daily basis.
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure, James.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. You're speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 18th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Health officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo reported 17 new Ebola cases on Wednesday, bringing the total number of cases to nearly 1,200. Trust among patients and even healthcare workers has been hard to win over in the east of the country. Dr. Michelle Yao, Ebola Response Coordinator for the World Health Organization in North Kivu, spoke to Ricky Stryak about efforts to increase trust among community members and healthcare workers.
From the community resistance, of course, we had the societies that try to understand the reasons. And some is that we're coming for Ebola, but they have other priorities, including even security and also service to other healthcare, like malaria, vaccination, or ensuring that the health facility do have an appropriate maternity for childbirth. So all these needs were put in front, and we have to address them in parallel. The other point is of the reason is that it's the places where it not have Ebola in the past, even if we have experienced Ebola outbreak before this one. So it was new, and bringing in aspects was also a challenge.
I understand that there are efforts from WHO to help their partners and local facilities create isolation units within local community centers so that people might not have to move to the ETU until they are confirmed. Is that correct? And what kind of effort does that look like?
It's correct. It's part of the community approach. It's part of our shifting to strategy to totally involved in this response. So one element is to get closer to them, the isolation or what we call the transit center, where we keep the suspected cases until we have lab confirmation of the factors. So the idea is to ensure that people remain into the health facilities that they know. Till we get confirmation. So our role is to ensure that we equip these centers, we train the health workers. We have more than 10 facilities where we have started this process, and it looks like it's more accepted that people are moving far away into a treatment center.
A lot of the new deaths are unfortunately are happening outside of the Ebola treatment centers. What does this mean for the continued spread of the disease?
Ebola outbreak is actually a community outbreak. It's based on practices to the community. And the controllers, we need them to be on board. And one of the elements is actually suspected death. To make sure that at least a health professional confirm the cause of death.
That was Dr. Michelle Yao, Ebola Response Coordinator for the World Health Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Butembo in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Rwanda's national airlines on Wednesday began direct flights to Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. As Eugene Iwimana reports from Kigali, businesses and potential passengers say the new air route will reduce travel time and expenses as well as boost trade between Rwanda and the DRC.
The Boeing 737-800NG plane left Kigali at exactly 10 Wednesday morning. Rwanda Airlines says it will operate three weekly direct flights from Kigali International Airport to Kinshasa's Jili International Airport. For passengers, this new route is very important as it cuts short their time and expenses. This is going to highly help us. Before, for me to come to Kigali, I had to pass Brazzaville. But now, instead of taking Ethiopian or other airlines, this Rwandair route will enable us to come straight to Kigali. We who do business have waited this route for so long. Now we are going to Kinshasa and see what we can trade with Congolese. This marks good bilateral relations, which is not only country to country, but people to people. Yvonne Manzimakoro, the chief executive officer of Rwanda Airlines, says this Kigali to Kinshasa route is going to boost trade among Rwandans and Congolese.
Kinshasa is a very important route for us. It's been a long time coming. We believe that we need to facilitate the movement between the citizens of Congo and Rwanda so they can trade, they can visit each other. So that's the main thing, and most importantly for trade.
Authorities say this first flight is the quick implementation of the bilateral service air agreement signed in Kigali in March by both countries. It is also the result of the first meetings of DRC President Félix Tshisekedi and his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame.
Nos pays resteront voisins pour toute la vie.
Our countries have and will always be neighbors. We politicians are simply passing actors. We must therefore exercise our leadership responsibilities to stop the senseless conflicts that only distract us from investing our resources in important partnerships that would transform our people and countries. Our vision is to build the ports, not walls, between us. Rwanda DRC relations were called during President Joseph Kabila's administration due to the fact that Congo's vast forest is home to FDLR rebel group, which Rwanda says has been carrying out several attacks to destabilize Kigali. But according to President Paul Kagame, the new Tshisekedi's administration seems to be a new era that aims at removing all thorns. The era that Kagame believes will positively change things.
Let's test it and see where it takes us.
The new Kigali-Kinshasa route will operate on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays. According to Rwandan Central Bank data, DR Congo remains the main destination for Rwanda's informal exports. It accounts for nearly 9% of Rwanda's informal cross-border exports. Kinshasa is the third largest urban area in Africa after Lagos and Cairo. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
After 3 days in Ethiopia, President Trump's daughter and White House senior advisor Ivanka Trump is in Ivory Coast, the last stop of her four-day visit aimed at increasing economic opportunities for women in Africa. On Wednesday, she announced a $2 million project to support women in Ivory Coast cocoa industry. But her trip to Africa comes as President Trump has criticized foreign aid under his America First policy. White House correspondent Patsy Wadikuswara reports.
Africa is the only region in the world where more women than men choose to become entrepreneurs. And in Addis Ababa, White House advisor Ivanka Trump toured female-owned businesses where she tried her hand at weaving at a textile factory and sampled Ethiopian coffee, while promoting a White House global economic initiative for women.
We believe that investing in women is smart development policy, and it's smart business. It's also in our security interests, because women, when they're empowered, foster peace and stability. We've seen this play out time and time again.
The initiative aims to create opportunities for women in the workplace and in business through capacity building, financing, and pushing to change norms and laws that hinder women from prospering. Globally, women are paid 63% of what men earn. In more than half of the world's countries, women still cannot run a business the same way as men. They have difficulties in getting credit, signing contracts, and opening bank accounts. Another huge obstacle, access to education.
We need, first and foremost, to concentrate on our universities, to have educated women able to graduate from universities, because they have many obstacles.
The Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative, championed by Ivanka Trump and signed by her father in February, allocates initial funding of $50 million to help 50 million women around the world become economically independent by 2025. Under his America First policy, President Trump has repeatedly pushed to slash foreign aid in favor of military spending. But this initiative indicates the administration is in line with four decades of previous American presidents' policies to empower women globally.
It's not radically new, but it signals continuity. And so if you supported women's economic empowerment in the Obama administration, then you should be willing to give the Trump administration a chance and take them seriously now.
In Ethiopia, Ivanka Trump hosted a women's empowerment dialogue at the United Nations Economic Commissions for Africa and announced OPEC2X Africa, a $350 million financing effort from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for businesses owned and led by women or those working to help them. Patsy Widakuswara, BOA News at the White House.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has been taken to a prison in the capital 5 days after the military removed him from power and put him under house arrest. Relatives of the ousted president said Bashir, who's 75, was moved to Khartoum's Kobar prison on Tuesday and is being held under tight security. He has not been seen in public since the army toppled him in a coup last Thursday, following months of street protests triggered by escalating prices for food and fuel. Thousands of demonstrators remain outside army headquarters in Khartoum, pressing their demands for a civilian-led transition in government. The coup leader said last week a military-run council will run the country for 2 years. The African Union and several Western countries have called for a fast transition to civilian leadership and elections. The United Nations said Wednesday that the Libyan capital saw its most intense fighting overnight since the forces of General Khalifa Haftar began their battle to take Tripoli earlier this month. The UN top diplomat in Libya, Ghassan Salami, condemned the shelling on Twitter as a horrible night of random shelling of residential areas. For the sake of 3 million civilians, he said, living in Greater Tripoli, he said these attacks should stop. In a statement to the media on Tuesday, Salami renewed his call for international unity to spare Libya from the devastating consequences of a civil war. And U.S. President Donald Trump's daughter and senior White House advisor Ivanka Trump spoke to a summit of women entrepreneurs in the Ivory Coast on Wednesday. That is it for this Thursday, April 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strike, as well as post-editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.